This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
It's a sincere honor to welcome to this program Bob Sorley. He is a third-generation graduate of West Point. He holds a doctorate from Johns Hopkins University. He has served in the U.S. Army, on staff at the Pentagon, and later as a senior civilian official at the Central Intelligence Agency. His book, very well known, a celebrated book, A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. It's now in paperback, and we're giving away a free copy here at the end of the interview. Bob, it's a great honor to talk to you. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, sir. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I want to start actually with the most recent news, the fact that we have learned that President Obama, Vice President Biden, they're reading your book, they're discussing your book. Tell me your thoughts when you heard that that your book was the senior advisors at the White House where everybody was talking about it.
Well, to be honest with you, I was quite astounded. The book first came out 10 years ago. And my purpose in writing it was to tell what I believe to be the neglected or even unknown story of the later years of our involvement in the war in Vietnam. And I do think that if we're looking back to earlier conflicts, including Vietnam, for any lessons learned that might be applied now or other times in the future, it's extremely important that we learn the true or right lessons. So that was my purpose. Of course, I'm gratified that it may be having some effect now.
Yeah, absolutely. So share with us, if you can, a few of the lessons that you picked up from your research.
Yes.
That you think are important lessons that the advisors and the president should be thinking about that might provide lessons as we move forward and some way forward here.
Yes. All the better known books about the war in Vietnam focused primarily on the early years of our involvement, a period when the American general in command was William C. Westmoreland. And General Westmoreland's approach to the conduct of the war was to kill as many of the enemy as he could, the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong. His premise was that if he killed enough of them, the enemy would lose heart and give up its aggression against South Vietnam. And he did, in fact, kill an enormous number of the enemy, but they just replaced them with more. And so that desired outcome didn't eventuate, and meantime, he was neglecting two other very important aspects of the war. One was building up South Vietnam's armed forces so they could be better able to take over responsibility for the security of their own country. And even more important than that, he was failing to dig out the covert infrastructure that the enemy had established in South Vietnam's hamlets and villages, where the enemy was using coercion and terror to keep the population under its control. So those big battles out in the deep jungle were having absolutely no effect on the place where it really mattered, the villages and the people. In the latter years, after the famous Tet of 1968 offensive, American forces there were commanded by a new general named Creighton Abrams. And I had written a biography of General Abrams titled Thunderbolt, which was the name of his tank in World War II. And I thought that he was a very interesting man. And then when I began to look into what happened when he took command in Vietnam, I was confirmed in that judgment. A colleague said the tactics changed within 15 minutes of Abrams taking command. General Abrams had a different concept of the nature of the war and therefore of how it should be fought. And his thought was, he used the term one war. We have to deal with all aspects of this war at once or we'll fail. So, yes, he had to continue with the military part, the battles, although he changed the approach very greatly. But secondly, he made a major effort to upgrade South Vietnam's armed forces. In the early period, General Westmoreland had hogged all the better weapons for American forces, and so the poor South Vietnamese were outgunned in most of the battles that they fought because the communists were giving their North Vietnamese and Viet Cong allies the AK-47, a great assault weapon, now world famous.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Americans were getting all the M-16s. When Abrams took command, he said, no, the Vietnamese get first priority on the best weapons, including the M-16.
Interesting.
And not only the Vietnamese, but the so-called territorial forces who were the ones who were defending where their families lived and where their livelihood was, and even where their ancestral grave sites were. And so that was a huge difference. So the first lesson, and perhaps the most important, that I would seek to emphasize is, if you're going to draw any lessons from the Vietnam War, let's understand what really happened there. And the earlier part was, I hate to say, pretty much of a disaster for us and for our allies. And the later part, I'm emboldened to call a better war, because everything went much better.
Yeah. We're talking with Bob Sorley. His classic book is A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. It's become must reading at the White House as President Obama tries to find, he and his advisors try to find a way forward. Share with us, Bob, if you can. I'm all ears. The other lessons you think that are key here when we look at both yes. Iraq and Afghanistan, and what we should be doing that we're not doing.
Well, it may not be so much of what we're not doing, but it might be more of what we are doing or what we know we need to do. I had the experience of just a few days ago of sitting in on a conference where General Petraeus talked to an audience of veterans and students, and he was very articulate and very interesting. And one of the things he said, this has become a saying, is you can't commute to a counterinsurgency war. And what that means is you can't put your forces out sequestered, you know, in a secure area apart from the people and expect to have any influence. That's just like Westmoreland being out in the deep jungle when the people in the villages are being coerced and terrorized by the communist infrastructure.
Right.
So his message is you've got to mix in with the people. And the first and most important thing is to provide security to the people so they cannot be terrorized and coerced. And in the war in Vietnam in the latter years, as I've indicated, things were going much better, there was a man named George Jacobson who started out there as a colonel, remarkable man. I believe he served 18 years in Vietnam altogether. And in the latter years, he was very important in the pacification program. And he said, you know, people differ in their views as to whether security is 10% of pacification or 90% of pacification, but they will all agree that it's the first 10% or the first 90%. You just can't conduct pacification with an NVA division tromping through the backyard. So, that you know, there is a key point also.
Yeah.
Be in with the people, cast your lot with the people, and then bend every effort to make them as secure as you can. So, first of all, they can carry on a viable economic life, and that they can cooperate with the government without fear of retribution from the enemy.
Bob, we're talking with Bob Sorley. The book is A Better War, and we'll be giving away a copy here at the end of the interview. Bob, how did we get to the point where the generals who came out of Vietnam, and I'm thinking of men like Shinseki, I mean, true American heroes,
yes.
who came out of Vietnam and really studied what happened.
Yes.
In the 70s and the 80s, and they knew what they needed to do to rebuild this army. How did it happen that we got to the point now where those lessons, it's like those lessons just evaporated and they were gone and we had to rediscover them again?
You know, I appreciate your saying that, but I haven't figured it out yet. we replicated the pattern of Vietnam, didn't we? I hate to say this, but in the first part of the war in Vietnam, we had an uncomprehending commander who thought that if you just the more people you killed and the more firepower you threw around, the better you were going to do, and that didn't work. And he was commander for 4 years, and then General Abrams came in and he understood the war and the implications. General Abrams once told a collection of the ambassadors from Southeast Asia that in the whole sweep of this war, the battles don't really matter very much. And that's just the opposite of you know, that focus on body count and all that. And so then, you know, things got much better. Of course, in a better war, I claim there came a point at which the war was won. Well, obviously, I'm obliged to explain how there came a point later when it was no longer won. And basically, the answer to that is the American body politic, especially the Congress, ran out of patience, and they just got tired of the whole thing, and they pulled the plug on the poor South Vietnamese. And then, as you've indicated, we see the same pattern in Iraq. We send people out there who think that the more firepower you can bring to bear, the better you're doing. And of course, they did have to clean out the Iraqi army, and that was good. But then they built themselves secure base camps in which they sequestered themselves apart from the people, and things went, you know, not very well. And then we get David Petraeus out there, and David understands exactly what you and I have been talking about.
Yeah,
he begins to do the same kinds of things that General Abrams began to do with, I'm going to say, it seems to me, similar good outcome. And so now it appears we're trying to do the same thing in Afghanistan, and I hope it's not too late, and I hope that the situation there will permit that to be done successfully.
We're honored to be talking with Bob Sorley. He's a third-generation graduate of West Point. He's got a doctorate from Johns Hopkins. He's served in the U.S. Army on staff at the Pentagon and was a senior civilian official at the CIA. His classic book is A Better War, and it is must-reading now in the White House. Bob, help us understand, as we aren't privileged to the conversations that you get to have. So what we get as just average Americans is, you know, what the nightly news tells us or what we can get on the websites. And help us understand moving forward what we might expect now in Afghanistan and from the White House and what we should be looking for some metrics of success.
Yeah, well, that is the key question, of course. I don't want to pretend to more insider status than I really have. I think the only reason you and I are talking now is because people like General Petraeus found the book useful and of interest, and have called it to the attention of people who are, you know, the senior decision makers now, and they're trying to decide what to do. You know, as I do, only from press accounts, that the president has had a fairly lengthy series of meetings with his senior national security advisors.
Right.
I believe the current count is 10 such sessions, extended sessions. And some people have complained about that and said, you know, this is foot-dragging and so on. I have a little different outlook. We all know that this president, who, of course, is also our commander-in-chief, came to the post without military background or experience. So I actually think it's probably a good thing that he is going into extended conversation and discussion with his senior advisors, both those in uniform and people like the Secretary of Defense, during which time I believe he is probably getting, if you want to put it this way, getting an education in what the role and responsibilities of the Commander-in-Chief are. So I think they've had 10 meetings now. The press seems to indicate that he's going to tell us within the next few days, if not by the end of this week, perhaps early next week, what decisions he has made. And you know that he sent a new general out there and asked him to evaluate what was needed in order to accomplish the mission. And so then he's gotten a report on that. And we will see how close to what he was told he was asked for he decides to go. But it sounds like, if the press accounts are at all right, that he's going to be pretty much in the ballpark of what his new general there has asked for, and so then we'll see if the thing can be carried forward. Here's you asked for the metrics of success, and that's a very good question, and the answer is probably going to be a little more amorphous than you would like, but General Petraeus, when I heard him recently talk, reminded us that the reason we're there in the first place is to diminish and, if possible, eliminate the bases of support for international terrorism that threaten our interests at home and around the world and those of our allies. And so to the extent that can be done, then I think we would say that to that extent we have succeeded. There are a lot of other desirable things there, you know, such as the economic viability of the Afghan workforce and so on, but those are secondary. The real objective, and this is what we need to keep our eye on, I think, is reducing the threat of terrorism from that part of the world.
We're talking with Bob Sorley. The book is A Better War. Are we seeing here from Vietnam on, are we seeing sort of a redefining of the U.S. armed forces from what, you know, what we saw perhaps in World War II with the big tanks rolling across the fields of Africa and the Battle of the Bulge and huge firepower,
yeah,
on a massive scale? And are we seeing sort of a redefining towards this counterterrorism where the U.S. Armed Forces becomes sort of like a police force writ large?
Well, that's, that's a very good question, and I think the answer is to some extent, yes, we are. But it's not the first time. On Veterans Day, I had the privilege of giving a talk at Fort Meade, Maryland, commemorating our veterans. And that was a nice place for me because it was my first station when I became a young officer. And in my talk, I remarked at one point about my grandfather's service, first in the Indian Wars at the very end of that, and then in the Spanish-American War, he went to Cuba, and then he went out to the Philippines to help put down insurrections there. So, you know, we have a history of this kind of thing, interrupted by some big wars like the ones you just described, and now we seem to be back to wars of the kind that we knew in our earlier days. Now, we did, of course, have a huge armored force in the field under my classmate Norm Schwarzkopf in the first Gulf War in 1991.
Right, right.
But against a fairly inept opponent, I would have to say. And this is a little funny. I don't have. I'll keep it short. But
you have all the time you want, sir.
When I was out in Vietnam, I was the executive officer of a tank battalion. That means the number two guy in command of a tank battalion. And I served two different battalion commanders during my year there. The first one wanted to put this tank battalion online and fight it just the way you were talking about, the way General Abrams fought his in World War II. And we were in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, and there just was no opportunity for that. And he parceled out our tanks and did good things with them. And then he left, and another officer came in, and it was just like Westmoreland and Abrams. This new officer understood the nature of the war. He saw that we were not going to put the tank battalion online in the jungle and so on. And so we started putting out platoons of tanks. That's five tanks, you know, small groups of tanks here, there, and the other. And when the infantry would get involved with the enemy and be able to pin them down long enough for us to gallop out there and do some good, we did a lot of good. So it all goes back to understanding the nature of the war and what will work and what won't work in that context. I do think that now we have some very able men, both in charge of the forces deployed and advising the President and the Secretary of Defense.
And that is indeed encouraging.
Yeah, that's the only way we're going to be able to succeed, is if we have able men who understand what's needed and are able to then bring that to bear, if they have the backing and support, not only of the Commander-in-Chief, of course, but of the Congress and the American people. That may be, I'm backing up here just a moment.
Yeah, it's fine.
That may be one of the reasons the President has taken all the time he has and so visibly done so, because another problem we had in the Vietnam era, both in early and later years, was the Commanders-in-Chief never really got the backing of the American people in the degree that would have been desirable. And I think this President may well be sensitive to the need to do that, and this is maybe part of his efforts to do so.
Bob Sorley, he's a third-generation West Point graduate, and he served in the U.S. Army, on staff at the Pentagon, and with the CIA. His classic book is A Better War, The Unexamined Victories and Final Tragedy of America's Last Years in Vietnam. It's now being read by President Obama and Vice President Biden and their advisors as they decide how to move forward in Iraq and Afghanistan. Bob, it really a great honor to talk to you, and I wish you a fantastic Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much, sir. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.